frozen tundra. Green Bay's choice for news talk. 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Vice President Kamala Harris securing a huge and surprising endorsement Friday from Dick Cheney, George W. Bush's vice president, declaring he'll vote for Harris in November.
Trump yesterday dismissed Cheney, calling him irrelevant. He also celebrated a new endorsement that he got from the Fraternal Order of the Police. He promised to be tough on crime, but he spent much of his time there when he was talking to the police officers, talking about how much he didn't trust the law enforcement system, how much he was sort of felt prosecuted.
ABC's Mary Alice Parks, father and son in court 2 days after the mass shooting at a Georgia high school. The suspected shooter, facing four counts of felony murder, his father charged with manslaughter and murder for allegedly allowing the teen access to the rifle used to gun down two students and two teachers. Boeing Starliner landed in New Mexico overnight without the two astronauts who flew it into space. Problems on the capsule, stranding them on the International Space Station until next February. This is ABC News. Wynn Las Vegas will be paying out a record amount of money in a fine for how it was allegedly trying to attract foreign gamblers.
According to federal prosecutors in San Diego, Wynn Las Vegas admits it was illegally using unregistered money transmitting agents to circumvent the conventional financial system by using a roundabout way to transfer money to attract foreign gamblers to Wynn, allowing those gamblers to evade foreign and U.S. laws governing money transfers and reporting. Wynn is agreeing to pay over $130 million dollars in a fine. The U.S. attorney in San Diego is saying that's the largest ever by a casino for an admission of criminal wrongdoing. Alex Stone, ABC News.
A preliminary report on last month's Brazilian plane crash that killed all 62 people on board reveals the pilots reported a failure in the plane's de-icing system. Investigators caution that more work is needed, but the findings support experts' theory that ice on the wings led to lift loss. Dave Packer, ABC News.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinair on Air with Jane Matinair. Weekdays 10 till noon on the talk of Green Bay, 97.9 FM and 1590 AM WGBW, and on the Civic Media app.
I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News. Your news in depth. Find it in the news section at WGBW.FM.
I learned patience from my adoptive dad. All he had to say was,
"Hey, you got this. Just breathe." Hey, we're pretty good.
Yeah.
Might have to start a band.
I got it.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org to find out more. This message is brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
You are listening to your local Civic Media radio station on air. Thank you. Did you know we are always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app too? And if you miss a show or game, find it wherever you get your podcasts or on our website, civicmedia.us.
News, I'm Terry Bell. 50,000 people on Medicare Part D in Wisconsin can expect to save about $1,500 each next year with new federal out-of-pocket caps on prescription drug costs. Mike Mohn reports.
The Inflation Reduction Act, signed into law 2 years ago, includes several provisions designed to address affordability issues for people needing medications. Most of the changes are meant to help Medicare enrollees. Starting January 1st, the new rule will cap out-of-pocket drug costs at $2,000 annually for those under Medicare's Part D. David Bowen with AARP Wisconsin details the estimated savings.
Medicare drug plan enrollees nationwide who reach the new out-of-pocket cap will see an added savings of roughly $1,500 or 56%. In 2025.
At the state level, the analysis predicts these savings will benefit nearly 50,000 Wisconsinites next year. Other IRA provisions have already kicked in, including a $35 cap on monthly insulin costs for Medicare recipients. Bowen says the pending out-of-pocket changes mean older people dealing with health issues such as diabetes will get much-needed relief when refilling their prescriptions. Collectively, he says these moves should get to the core of the cost issue consumer advocates have been talking about for years.
We have older Wisconsinites that are choosing either limiting their supply of their prescriptions, or they literally are taking resources that are used to pay for other essentials to sometimes cover the cost.
Last month, the Biden administration unveiled price reduction agreements for their first group of Medicare-covered drugs included in negotiations with manufacturers. The lower cost of those drugs takes effect in 2026. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Sunshine today, highs in the low to mid-60s. Mostly clear tonight with lows around 47. Sunny and breezy for Sunday. Highs around 75 and southwest winds at about 15 to 20 miles per hour. Monday, sunshine 80, 82 on Tuesday.
Right now, it's 49.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, Jane Matinair returns to the big chair, and we are talking about the election because we are less than 2 months away, people. Join us.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Matinair on air.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review. This is our weekly weekend review of all things rule of law, government, and the aspiration for justice related. Thank you once again for joining me this weekend, as we once again tackle some of those big issues in the news, in the areas of issues coming out of our courts in particular, and other areas of our lives and our livelihoods. My name is Jim Santel, and I'm your host for this hour and also the next hour of Amicus, a Law Review. As you know, we take our name from the Latin, ami, which is an individual, a person who assists and understands and promotes appreciation and assessment of some relevant issues that have to be decided, resolved, maybe sometimes by a court, often by a community, others who are responsible for figuring out what's going on and what should happen in the wake of that. Amicus is a way of describing the mission that we adopt here on this broadcast to provide you with some review, some analysis, some deliberation, some consideration of those recent news items of our times in the areas of law and government and justice as well. This weekend, no exception to that. Lots of late-breaking news in the area of rule of law, and we're going to get to that in this segment and in the next segments of this hour and next hour as well. Let me tell you a bit about what that is on our agenda for this weekend. Major stories coming out of Washington and New York just this past week, both on Thursday and Friday of this week. Some major announcements and some major actions by a federal judge, by a state court judge, together handling two very different kinds of cases in two different jurisdictions, one federal, one state. We're going to talk about a major decision made by Judge Juan Merchan just on Friday of this past week, making the decision to postpone until November not only his deliberation on a major pretrial issue in the case that he is presiding over, but also postponing the sentencing of Donald Trump, a candidate for the presidency right now, former president of the United States of America, the first person in the presidency ever to be convicted of a felony, actually 34 felonies in New York. We'll talk about what Judge Juan Merchan did just on Friday of this past week, that's going to affect not only the future of that particular case, including the sentencing and appeals that will certainly follow, but also, of course, the intersection between that particular prosecution and the political world in which we're living right now. And then we're going to talk about Tanya Chutkan, another judge. She is a federal judge. She is presiding over the federal election interference case, that one pending in Washington, D.C., the trial court going ahead right now in our nation's capital. And between the two of them together, the messages, the news coming out of those two different courts, underscoring two very different views, two dramatically different views, almost conflicting views between Judge Merchan and Judge Chutkan about the extent, if any, that our present political atmosphere, our climate, the campaign for the presidency should have on the conduct of the rule of law, on the process of justice in those courtrooms. Two very different views. Judge Merchan taking the position that because of the campaign and because of the fact that in about 2 months from now, we're going to be electing a next president of the United States of America. Because of that, he is obliged to take that into account and make decisions, at least procedurally, maybe substantively as well, but certainly procedurally, that affect the future of that case. Judge Tanya Chutkan saying and articulating just the opposite, saying something that's completely different from that and saying that, you know what, this particular defendant, like all defendants, is entitled to all of the due process protection of the Constitution and of our federal system, the laws of the federal courts, but is not going to be affected. The judge is not going to be affected by what's going on in the political realm, making that very clear when it comes to articulated positions that she was listening to this past week. We're going to talk about exactly what the two of them said, why they're coming to very different resolutions of how politics and campaigns and the movement toward the presidency should and should not affect what's going on in the courts of America. Then we're going to spend some time, as we necessarily need to do once again in America, talking about the latest horrific mass shooting in Winder, Georgia. We're going to talk about the victims of that school shooting. We're going to talk about the defendants, both father and son, now brought into court to hold them responsible, to hold them culpable, and to assign responsibility to them for what has happened here. We're going to talk then more generally about the implications, as we have done in the past, about what this latest mass shooting means for America, the things that we can do, in some places have done, to try to prevent these things from happening, and the political will that should put us beyond these kinds of things continuing to happen in America, what it is that our United States Congress, our legislators in states like Wisconsin and other places around the United States should be doing right now to address issues related, yes, to automatic weapons. We're going to talk about the history of that and the ways in which when those bans have been in place, we have had safer and more secure communities. We're going to talk also about lethal violence protective orders, ways in which we can address people who are threats to themselves and to others, and the mechanisms that can be legislatively implemented to ensure that people who are risks to themselves and others do not have weapons, at least temporarily. No violation of the Second Amendment there, no violation of the Supreme Court rules and regulations and standards, if you will, coming out of Heller and Bruin, those two major cases that for the first time in our history established a personal right to gun ownership in the Second Amendment. We're going to talk about all of those implications as we go forward and talk about what happened in Winder, the community there and its response, even as late Friday, a second vigil held in connection with the losses, the injuries suffered not only by 9 people, but by the entire community, the victims themselves, 4 people. We're going to talk about exactly who they are and the losses, the diminution in the community suffered as a result of that. Then we're going to go back again to another court, this one in the West Coast. I'm going to talk about Hunter Biden, a major development in that case as well, a criminal prosecution. Hunter Biden entering a plea to tax charges, and the result of that, the exposure he now faces, likely spending some time in federal prison as a result of both the gun violation for which he's already been found guilty and now pleading guilty to a tax charge, several tax charges there in a federal district court. We will talk about exactly what that means, what it doesn't mean, and the implications for Hunter Biden generally. And then some rule of law snapshots, which we have not done in a long time. We're going to talk about the international consequences of some major news stories. Yes, they're related to domestic matters here, involving law and government and the aspiration for justice, but also places overseas, places like Russia, once again involved in the 2024 election, an attempt to interfere with our election and what it is that our United States Department of Justice is doing, the Treasury Department is doing in terms of sanctions, in terms of initiatives to try to stop that from happening. And also the prosecutions coming out of the U.S. Department of Justice, again, not only in anticipation of the 2024 campaign, but while it is going on, what is the Department of Justice doing to prevent Russian interference in our campaign, in the decision-making process that we're leading up to in November of this year? Plainly, as a part of history, we know that in 2016, a huge amount of influence, 2020 influence as well, and now the Attorney General trying to get out front of this, announcing what has been going on, what will be going on in the times ahead to prevent Russia from influencing the votes and the elective process here in our nation. We will talk about something else that the Attorney General announced just this past week, and that is some prosecutions of some top leaders of Hamas for violations of human rights, civil rights, specifically focusing upon the deaths of Americans as a result of the Hamas attack on October 7th and other things in which Hamas has also been involved. We'll talk about exactly what it is that those prosecutions are all about, what it is that the government has said about the conduct of Hamas recently and traditionally in the past. We'll review all of that. And then we're also going to talk about what's going on in France, in connection with the owner operator of this online site called Telegram, allegedly a platform for unfettered statements, unfettered postings about all kinds of things, arguably, according to French authorities. And we'll talk a little bit more about the mechanisms by which the French proceed to investigate and review and charge and prosecute and convict and often sentence individuals in a system very different from ours, That system now snagging the head of Telegram. He has been in custody, released from custody recently. He's also speaking out now about the allegations against him and allegations that because of the unfettered access to his platform, promoting all sorts of kinds of criminal activities, not just in France, but around the world, a significant rule of law event going on in France that also, like these other stories, has its tendrils and its implications here in the United States of America. All of that here on Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for this hour and next hour as well. I am joined here in the studios of Civic Media by my terrific producer. His name is Max. And together, we're also going to be taking your phone calls at 844-967-2789. That phone number, once again, 844-967-2789. You can call, you can text, you can drop a note, an inquiry, a question that you may have about the topics that are on our syllabus today. Engage us in that conversation. Pleased to be including you in our discussion, soliciting also your perspectives on these issues, especially when it comes to the very first issue which we're going to be addressing, and that is this major decision involving the singular case in which Donald Trump, candidate for the presidency, is going to be sentenced at some point. That sentencing now postponed until after the election. Lots of different views on all sides of the political aisle about the legitimacy, the rightness, the correctness of that decision. We'll talk about what Judge Merchan said, and we'll consider some alternative views about what could or should have happened as this matter goes forward here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
At Fleet Farm, we know every opening day doesn't begin and end with us. But if it did, we've got you covered. Everyday hunting gear from Winchester, Remington, and Bear. Everyday fishing gear from Daiwa, St. Croix, and Rapala. Everyday yard cleanup from Scott's, Fiskars, and Agri-Fab. Whatever makes your day, we're right there with you. At Fleet Farm, we've got everything you need for everyday life.
The first highly anticipated debate between Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump is Tuesday night, September 10th.
Listen here as the presidential candidates address issues important to you.
It's not sustainable. It's not affordable by any country.
I know what we are fighting for. We're not fighting against something. We're fighting for.
Special coverage with detailed insights starts at 7:30 p.m.
Then listen to the ABC presidential debate live at 8, Tuesday, September 10th on your local Civic Media radio station.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. I am your host for this first hour of our weekend broadcast. Also, the second hour coming up. During both of those hours, my producer Max and I taking your questions, your inquiries, both by phone, 844-967-2789. Call us, text us. You can also drop some notes to us in the Civic Media app. Here through any of the broadcast stations of Civic Media statewide, delighted, as always, to have you with us, enjoying, hopefully, our presentation, our review of the major news stories of this past week in the areas of law and government and the aspiration for justice. Let's get right to the very first of those promised on our syllabus. It has to do with this significant event in human history, in American history, in the rights and obligations that we afford to all criminal defendants in our system. That is to be heard in a court of law, to have your case decided based upon fundamental rights and principles that give you the opportunity to defend against cases brought by the government, to put the government to its proof, to ensure that whatever happens, whether there is a guilty verdict, whether there is a not guilty verdict, that a jury has all of the relevant information in front of it. There are appellate rights associated with that. There are all kinds of things, pretrial, trial, appellate rights that go along with that. And throughout the trial of Donald Trump, that is the trial that was presided over by Judge Juan Merchan. He is a superior court judge. He's actually called a justice. That's the way that New York folks describe the judges in their system. Judge Juan Merchan presiding over this major hush money false statements case, which really, as we have talked before, is in the nature of an election interference case. It goes way back to 2016, as you know well. A prosecution is based upon allegations and now proven allegations that Donald Trump and others falsified records to cover up the payments to Stormy Daniels, who had threatened to go public in 2016, right before the 2016 election, of her account of a sexual encounter with Donald Trump way back in 2006. All of that, you know well, much bandied about by the media nationally, locally, and throughout the world. In May, a jury properly constituted as a part of those principles, those standards that are attended upon every single criminal defendant, every single prosecution, state, federal prosecution in our nation, a jury found beyond a reasonable doubt, unanimously, 12 people, the former president was in fact and is in fact guilty of 34 counts of violations of New York law for falsifying records about what it was he was doing, trying to cover up exactly the nature of those transactions with people like his fixer, Michael Cohen, and others, David Pecker, all kinds of people whose names we recall from the trial of way back in May, about 4 months ago, there in the court in Manhattan. Well, what happened just this past week is a significant change in the schedule following that finding by the jury. Judge Juan Merchan, presiding over the case, had initially, you may recall, established a July date, July 11th, for the scheduling and the conduct of the sentencing hearing of the defendant, Donald Trump, on those 34 counts. That is routine. There are an awful lot of circumstances where, in America, judges do, in fact, sentence immediately upon conviction. That can happen. But most often in cases like this, where there's significance not only to the prosecution, to the defendant, to the importance that the community assigns to a particular case, when these kinds of things happen, not at all unusual, fairly common, as a matter of fact, for the judges to say,
What I'd like to do is I'd like to gather together information, not only about the trial, but everything I can possibly find out about the defendant in particular, your history, your background, your economic background, your educational background, your family, the kinds of things that produced you today, that brings you into court, and all of that as a part of ensuring that the process, once again, premised upon due process, premised upon fundamental notions that we want to get it right. All of that premised upon providing the judge with as much information as possible, an awful lot of things judges can take into account when it comes to sentencing. And that's what's been going on between the time of late May and, frankly, even to this day. That is the judge ordering a pre-sentence report, assembling all of this information so that when the sentencing comes, he, in this case, Juan Merchan, has all the information possible to try to focus on the best sentence, the most appropriate sentence to be imposed upon this defendant. Now, we know under federal law that based upon the crimes of conviction, this defendant, Donald Trump, would face about 4 years in prison. That's not to say that the judge has to impose that. There's no obligation to do it. All kinds of options out there for Judge Juan Merchan, including probation, including some term of service in custody in combination with probation, community service, very likely some sort of fines, some criminal impositions also as a part of his judgment. All of that to be premised upon not only the conduct that was the focus of the trial, but also all kinds of other things related to who this defendant is, to make certain once again that whenever the judgment is entered, the final sentence is imposed, it is premised upon the most complete information that the judge has. And so that's what's been going on, and that's what the judge intended to do on July 11th. And then what we know, of course, happened. And that is on July 1, the United States Supreme Court issued this major catastrophic decision that changed our Constitution, that said that, you know what, American presidents do in fact have certain kinds of immunities. Can't touch them for certain kinds of crimes that they commit, may commit while in the Oval Office. A stunning decision by the Supreme Court, changing forever the ways in which we understand government and the role of the rule of law, the notion that no one is above the law. Well, it turns out, according to the Supreme Court, that at least one person, the president of the United States of America, arguably those who are beyond the presidency, also beyond the scope of the law. In the wake of that decision, their immunities, defense counsel for Donald Trump in the state court prosecution there in Manhattan, as they should do, as they are obliged to do to provide an adequate and aggressive defense on behalf of their client, Donald Trump, they filed motions and they said, you know what? That Supreme Court case now requires Judge Merchan that you turn back and reconsider whether or not the jury verdict returned by that jury in this case should be overturned, should be vacated, maybe the entire case dismissed, maybe at a minimum the case retried based upon some of the evidentiary limitations that the court also imposed. And that's what the judge has been deciding. He has been ruminating on that, thinking about it, soliciting memorandums and statements of position on all of that. And as a result of that, what he did a while back is he changed that July 11th date to September 16th and September 18th and told us that he was going to be announcing his decision on the applicability of that immunity decision to the criminal case on September 16th. Just this past week, a major change in that. The judge previously saying, I'm going to announce my decision about the applicability of the immunity decision on the 16th. I will likely sentence the defendant, Donald Trump, on September 18th. Just this past week, just on Friday, Judge Juan Merchan saying, you know what, I'm going to postpone all of this. I'm going to decide to postpone the sentencing until November 26th after election date. And I will tell you more about the reasons for my disposition, whatever that may be, prior to that time. As Amicus Law Review continues, we'll talk about exactly what he said to postpone all of that and the implications of it, what could have happened, what should have happened, as Amicus Law Review continues.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Vice President Kamala Harris securing a huge and surprising endorsement Friday from Dick Cheney. George W. Bush's vice president, declaring he'll vote for Harris in November.
Trump yesterday dismissed Cheney, calling him irrelevant. He also celebrated a new endorsement that he got from the Fraternal Order of the Police. He promised to be tough on crime, but he spent much of his time there when he was talking to the police officers, talking about how much he didn't trust the law enforcement system, how much he was sort of felt prosecuted.
ABC's Mary Alice Parks, father and son in court 2 days after the mass shooting at a Georgia high school. The suspected shooter, facing four counts of felony murder, his father charged with manslaughter and murder for allegedly allowing the teen access to the rifle used to gun down two students and two teachers. Boeing Starliner landed in New Mexico overnight without the two astronauts who flew it into space. Problems on the capsule, stranding them on the International Space Station until next February. This is ABC News.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
The Packers lose in the season opener in more ways than one. Hi, I'm Jimmy Cuska with sports, filling in for Mike Clemens. The Green Bay Packers lost 34-29 to the Philadelphia Eagles. More concerning, however, is the status of quarterback Jordan Love, who was helped off the field with an apparent leg injury late in the game. Head coach Matt LaFleur didn't have any answers immediately following the game.
I don't know.
While the Packers had some bright spots, such as Jaden Reed's big game at receiver, it wasn't enough to slow down the Eagles.
Very disappointed. There was a lot of opportunities out there to win the game. We weren't good enough in the red area. We were plus two winning the football and ultimately didn't score enough points to win the game. I mean, give Philly a ton of credit. They made some big plays.
The Packers are off until September 15th when they'll take on the Indianapolis Colts. The Brewers play the Rockies today, coming off a 3-2 loss yesterday, and the Badgers play South Dakota in football this afternoon. For Civic Media, I'm Jimmy Cuska.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Sunshine today, highs in the low to mid-60s. Mostly clear tonight with lows around 47. Sunny and breezy for Sunday, highs around 75 and southwest winds at about 15 to 20 miles per hour. Monday, sunshine 80, 82 on Tuesday.
It's 51 at our studios.
Hey, Wisconsin, it's construction season, and the Wisconsin DOT wants to help you safely navigate work zones in your area. Check 511wi.gov or download the free 511 app to see current road work, closures, detours, and camera views on your route. Wherever your travels take you, know before you go with 511wi.gov. That's 511wi.gov. And remember, know before you go. Always park the phone while driving. Sponsored by the Wisconsin DOT.
The kids are heading back to class, but when the subject is school, we have to talk about the first kindergarten started in Wisconsin. Marguerite Schurz created what is known as America's First Kindergarten in 1856, teaching a small class at her family's home in Watertown. It's about 50 miles west-northwest of Milwaukee. So can you guess, when did kindergarten become part of the state's public school system? The answer coming up. Schurz learned about kindergarten in Germany, where the idea was common. It wasn't in America, and her class grew so quickly, she had to move to a bigger space. Today, the building remains as a Watertown museum. So did you guess when kindergarten became part of the public school system in the state? It was 1898. But 42 years prior, the Schurz School started it all, making this a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
Max Inc. on Civic Media with Mike and Wendy from Sunspot. Can you imagine the mosh pit on the bridge that could happen?
Oh, well, that's how the original series was, when they moved the camera, whenever they leave like the red alert. The,
right.
Yeah. That was the mosh pit.
Yeah. And everybody had to like fake like...
Right. Yeah, lean left, great. Lean right.
Yeah.
Join us for all the fun with Max Inc. on Saturday night, 6 to midnight, across the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app.
T. Schwaba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome the creator of the Meet the Parents franchise. Greg Liana joins the show to tell us where we can see his indie film classic, and casting director Rex Sykes.
Nightlight with P. Schwaba, weeknights 6 to 8.
Thank you.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, your host this hour and next hour, as well as we talk about government and courts and the rule of law, the administration of justice in America, talking right now about the administration of justice in a particular court, that is the Manhattan Criminal Court, presided over by Judge Juan Merchan, making this major decision to postpone the sentencing of Donald Trump beyond Election Day, well into late November. Let's go back and talk a little bit more about the history that leads up to all of this, including, of course, the finding by the jury, a conviction of 34 felony counts there in New York, and this interceding decision by the Supreme Court having to do with immunity, the petitions, the motions filed by defense counsel as a part of their legitimate defense of their client, the defendant, arguing to the judge, frankly, without much merit, but nonetheless arguing that the immunity decision should prompt Judge Merchan either to order a new trial based upon things that happened during the course of the trial or dismiss the case entirely, which is what Donald Trump continues to advocate for. The judge has that under advisement, which means he has been considering that. And that is a significant part of an observation here, which is that most other judges who have addressed this issue of immunity generally have, number one, found that there has not been an attachment of immunity to the presidency. But putting that to one side, putting to one side the legitimacy or illegitimacy of what the Supreme Court has done to carve out this change in our Constitution that says that, yes, indeed, a president can be above the law in certain instances. The question then presented by defense counsel to Judge Merchan, pending now for many, many weeks, is whether or not that immunity decision having to do with the presidency applies to a case in which the principal conduct, the principal events as set forth in the trial itself preceded the presidency. Most all of this happened in October and even before that of 2016. Before Donald Trump was in the presidency, before he took the oath of office in 2017. And yes, indeed, there were some tendrils, some checks signed afterwards while he was the president. And yes, indeed, some testimony about conversations that he had with people like Hope Hicks and others in his staff while he was the president. But the reality is that the focus of the prosecution had to do with pre-presidential events in which there is no legitimate claim that immunity would apply to a private citizen. And that's exactly what Donald Trump was while he was campaigning for before he became the president of the United States of America in January of 2017. And my point is just this, that particular argument, although it can and should be raised by an aggressive and effective defense counsel, can also be expeditiously taken care of. And indeed, it has been, believe it or not, along the way of Donald Trump's attempts to try to dissuade the movement forward of this case, done a number of things. He's repeatedly asked Judge Merchan to recuse himself, a petition that the judge has repeatedly denied, has pushed back on and said, no, I'm not doing that. Issued that order very summarily so he can, in fact, do it. Interestingly, Donald Trump also went to the federal court just recently. He went to the U.S. District Court there in the Southern District of New York and tried to get the case removed from the state court to the federal court. The case assigned to a judge, a federal judge named Alvin Hellerstein, H-E-L-L-E-R-S-T-E-I-N. He's a district court judge. He's a federal judge there in Manhattan. And in a four-page decision, four pages, that's all it took him, Federal District Court Manhattan said he could not evaluate Trump's claims of bias, saying those were issues for the state courts. And for that reason, I'm not going to remove this case from the state court. I'm not going to grab it out of the state court and bring it to the federal court. He said no. But more important, he said this. He said that Trump's claims that he should have immunity from criminal prosecution, again, based on this recent spurious and frankly shocking Supreme Court decision for official acts, he said those allegations, those claims were groundless, groundless. That's what the federal district court judge said in a four-page order. He noted the hush money payments were private. He said they were unofficial acts. They had nothing to do with the presidency, and they were outside the bounds of executive authority. That's all that the judge said in his brief but dispositive and clear order. He went on to say that there is nothing about this case that would bring it into a federal domain. He said the request is improper outside the district court's jurisdiction. He wrote that in a footnote.
And he suggested that Donald Trump's plea for the state case to be removed in federal court was also implicitly, explicitly a request to delay his sentence. And indeed it is. Certainly it is. The point of all of this is that you've got a federal district court judge taking up this motion to have the case, the state court case, removed to the federal court. And in four pages, fairly quickly after that motion is filed, almost overnight, he's put together a four-page decision that says all you need to know about the applicability of that immunity decision to the state court case. Once again, he says these allegations, these claims that he should have immunity from criminal prosecution based upon official acts, nothing official. Nothing official about hush money payments, he says. Those were private, unofficial acts. They were outside the scope of the presidency, and it would offer that Judge Alvin Hellerstein not only got it right, but got it right quickly and expeditiously. And my criticism, if you will, of the decision by Judge Juan Merchan, a judge that I respect, who has handled these cases and all these matters with great balance and great sensitivity and great judgment, is that he too could have decided this much more quickly. This is not a matter that requires a huge amount of deliberation. We can argue, and we will argue, and we do argue in another setting about whether or not the immunity decision of the Supreme Court should stop a prosecution. That's the Tanya Chutkan case, which we'll get to in just a few moments. But here, nothing about the decision by the Supreme Court on July 1 should bring an end to the state court prosecution. Again, because of timing, because of the substance of what's presented. And indeed, Alvin Bragg, in the course of proceedings, has told Judge Merchan just that, taking the position legitimately, rightly, legally, lawfully, that there's nothing about that Supreme Court case that prevents the judge from going ahead and sentencing Donald Trump, a decision that can and should have been made expeditiously. We're now 4 months after the jury convicted the former president, and we still have no clear statement by Judge Merchan about that very simple issue. Judge Alvin Hellerstein, federal court right down the street there in Manhattan, he comes to that conclusion very easily, very quickly, and rightly. And that's my criticism of Judge Juan Merchan. He has appropriately wrestled with all of these issues. And what did he say? What did he say in defense of his decision to postpone for a second time the sentencing? He said, we are citing right now a unique time frame that this matter currently finds itself in. And certainly he is right about that. We have never done this before. We've never had a president, a former president, who has been the subject of a criminal conviction. Donald Trump, a convicted felon, even as he goes ahead and appeals for your vote in November of this year. The judge going on to say that this is not a decision this court makes lightly. Juan Merchan saying it is the decision which in this court's view best advances the interests of justice. And in this decision, he writes, this matter is one that stands alone in a unique place in the nation's history. And what he's talking about, of course, is that he's doing this in the midst of a campaign. And this is where he departs from what Tanya Chutkan said the day before. Juan Merchan unmistakably deciding to postpone the sentencing. Why? Because we are in the middle of this campaign. And finding that his imposition of sentences, announcement of what should be a very simple decision on this immunity applicability, that and then presumably the following sentencing, all of that can no longer take place because of the pendency of the campaign. And the court's decision, of course, is getting a lot of attention on both sides of the political aisle. An awful lot of people can disagree with my view about what Judge Merchan has done. But again, a decision that comes 4 months after the jury verdict itself, a time during which all of these issues related to immunity have been briefed and could have been the result of resulted in a very clear statement. The decision came at the request of Donald Trump, who had asked the delay in sentencing partly to win more time to challenge his conviction on charges. He did falsify these records. And, of course, the judge's ruling effectively grants that request. Interestingly, Judge Merchan did take something of a defensive tone in his fairly brief order postponing all this. He said, I'm refusing to address some of Trump's supporting arguments for a delay, which he described as a litany of perceived and unsubstantiated grievances. So he's putting aside some things of what are out there already. And interestingly, he also vented some frustration at Alvin Bragg himself, the prosecutor. And here, too, I find this curious, that Alvin Bragg, who has brought this case to prosecution through his colleagues there in the DA's office, is not aggressively, appropriately, in the normal course of business, asking the judge now to sentence in a timely fashion, 4 months after the jury convicted this defendant, sentence this defendant now. Alvin Bragg has not taken that position. Instead, he has said, we'll defer to whatever the court wants to do. Instead of arguing that, yes, indeed, justice delayed, justice denied, that the people, like the defendant, have a right to a speedy disposition of all of this, Alvin Bragg doesn't say that. Instead, he says, judge, we'll let you do what you think is in the best interests of justice. And the court vents some frustration at that pursuit of this so-called middle ground, this articulation of a non-position by Alvin Bragg. He notes that despite the district attorney's stated neutrality, his prosecutor's filing had highlighted logistical challenges to a September sentencing and seemingly supports Donald Trump's bid for delay. Now, when you've got a petition filed by the defense to delay, and you've got non-opposition from the very people who brought the prosecution in the first place, frankly, under those circumstances, the decision by this judge, Juan Merchan, to delay perhaps is not all that surprising. And so that is the result of all of this. Again, the decision to postpone the sentencing well beyond the jury, beyond the election in November, based upon the jury verdict back in May. And what that does, of course, is it denies the people of America the capacity to know what it is that a judge who's presided over the trial, who is given authority and responsibility to oversee not only all of these proceedings, pre-trial proceedings, post-trial proceedings, which is where we're in right now, and yes, indeed, sentencing. What is it? What is it that all of those things that I described before result in? What is the balanced, what is the justice-based, the rule of law-based disposition that should happen for this person, this defendant, now found guilty? What is the result that should come of all of that information amassed for the judge? What is that determination made by that jurist who is now imposing sentence? I would argue that that is relevant not only in any time in American history to understand what has happened in the wake of a conviction, but especially right now, as we are just weeks away from an election. The people of America, an awful lot of folks out there, say that we should, in fact, have some disposition, at least to the sentencing of this case. And oh, beyond that, as we have said before, nothing about a sentencing going ahead in September, not quite 2 months before the election itself, would have meant that Donald Trump would be in prison between September and November. Almost certainly, whatever the judge does, whether he imposes a sentence of incarceration or not, almost certainly would have stayed that decision. That's a way of saying the judge is not going to require that it be executed, that Donald Trump go to prison right away, if indeed that's a part of the sentence. The judge doesn't have to impose a term of custodial confinement, could impose some other sentence, but would almost certainly stay that, prevent that from being put in place. Why? Because Donald Trump also has appellate rights. And those rights will take him to the state appellate court, the state Supreme Court, arguably, although perhaps not with great likelihood, to the United States Supreme Court. And all of that will take months, if not years, down the road. None of that would happen. No incarceration, no imposition of the sentence itself, if indeed the sentence is imposed in September. But it is information that would have benefited the people of America on all sides of the political aisle to know what the result of this case, at least at the trial court level, is. Appellate courts may disagree down the road, may have some things to say about the conduct of the trial, all the decisions made by Juan Merchan. But my argument this weekend is that we have entitlement to know about that as it goes ahead. When we return here on Amicus Larvae, we'll take a look at what Judge Tanya Chutkan did in a dramatically different way in another court in the United States of America.
This is the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW. Hey there, it's Carrie Joy with your Work Money Minute and a quick money-saving tip on some car maintenance that almost anybody can do. When I take my car in for routine service, they want to charge me for changing my car's cabin air filter. It costs maybe $50 plus parts, sometimes even more. But this one is pretty easy to do yourself in most cases. Just search YouTube for the make and model of your car and the words cabin air filter. There's videos that'll walk you through changing it. In a lot of cars, the cabin air filter is behind the glove box, so you don't even have to go under the hood. It takes no tools and 5 minutes to change it, even if you go slow. They cost about $30 or less on Amazon or at some local auto parts store. I think it's worth a shot to save $50 or more. And look, if everything goes sideways somehow, this won't hurt or stop your car from running if you have to go for help. For more money tips, check out workmoney.org. Till next time, this is Carrie Joy saying, take good care.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus Law Review, spending some time looking at this decision by Juan Merchan to postpone the sentencing of Donald Trump, scheduled for September 18th. Decision on the immunity decision on September 16th, well beyond the election now. November 12th is the date on which he has said he's going to announce his decision on this immunity issue. Decision that can and should be relatively easily taken care of. Already the subject of a decision, a limited and very straightforward decision by a federal judge finding that there's no there. Judge Merchan taking his time to do all this and then finding that because of the pendency of the campaign, the intersection between politics and what's going on, he necessarily has to postpone the trial, granting Donald Trump's request unopposed by the prosecution for a sentencing in late November. In doing this postponement, Judge Merchan writes, this should dispel any suggestion that the court will have issued any decision or imposed a sentence either to give an advantage to or create a disadvantage for any political party. And indeed, he is right about that. There's no doubt that by postponing this, you don't give anybody any further ammunition, if you will, to attack the decisions by federal district courts and state courts and people like Judge Merchan making these decisions inside this political time period. Nonetheless, nothing about this should have happened in the way it played out. A decision could have been issued a long time ago, and the sentencing could and should have gone forward in September, not because of politics, but because of the natural movement forward of any criminal prosecution towards sentencing and the notion that at some point, every criminal defendant, having been found guilty by a jury, should indeed have the judgment entered against him based upon what the presiding judge has concluded. An entirely different view of the intersection between campaigns and the elective process in which we're involved right now and what's going on in courts, articulated by Judge Tanya Chutkan. And she too had a hearing. We're hearing from her as well this past week on Thursday. She has a hearing on whether or not what should happen in her case, whether or not the immunity decision should prevent her from going ahead with the case, soliciting from the attorneys in this case, in the federal interference case, recommendations to her about what should happen in that case. And that federal district court judge in Washington, D.C., again, presiding over the 4-count superseding indictment returned against Donald Trump, saying that she would not let Donald Trump's campaign for the White House affect the schedule of the criminal case in which he stands accused, as you know well, of plotting to overturn the 2020 election. Judge Tanya Chutkan taking just the opposite position for what Judge Merchan has done in New York. After an hour-long hearing, the Judge Tanya Chutkan said the November election was simply not relevant, her words, to the timing of how Donald Trump's case should unfold. And again, she has before her the same kind of issue. How is this immunity decision going to be impacting the trial there? Much more relevant, an awful lot more in terms of an assignment given to her by the Supreme Court to figure out what it is that she now needs to do to address the immunity decision inside her responsibility for overseeing this case. It's a complicated task. It's no small task. Sorting through this newly revised indictment, deciding which of its many allegations need to be tossed out under the immunity decision and which ones, in fact, survive and go to trial. Now, during the course of the hearing, counsel for the special counsel, Jack Smith, his name is Thomas Windham, said that the government would send her a detailed brief within about 3 weeks laying out their views on why the entire new indictment can and should withstand the Supreme Court's immunity ruling. And indeed, Judge Chutkan embraced that and said, yes, I'm going to give you a deadline. It's in late September to file that brief, and we're going to go ahead. I'm going to address that issue. She also said along the way that there's no doubt that whatever she does in this case as to immunity and other things, whatever she does in this case is certainly going to have an impact upon the future progress of the litigation generally. It's going to be appealed, she said, to the Federal Appeals Court, probably on to the Supreme Court at some point down the road. But that does not prevent her, she says, from going ahead and making these decisions. Special counsel goes on to tell her on Thursday that the brief that he's going to submit would likely contain some new information, things like new FBI interviews with witnesses that would bolster the government's position that Donald Trump was not acting in an official capacity when he sought to reverse his defeat to Joe Biden in the 2020 election, but was rather acting in his private role as a candidate for office, which is also what many judges out there have addressed this before have already said. And so that brief is coming. Another interesting series of exchanges, however, in the context of Judge Tanya Chutkan saying that nothing about her decisions about going ahead is going to be impacted by the present campaign. Again, reaffirming that her conduct will not be affected by the campaign. Counsel for Donald Trump took a very different view of how the case should move forward. He said the debate about immunity should be pushed off until at least December after the election. And the defense is seeking, of course, to attack the prosecution on other grounds. Judge Chutkan pushing counsel on why he wanted to delay the discussions of immunity and prompting counsel to acknowledge he was concerned that some of the new information coming out here would somehow affect the campaign itself. The new information wanted to include in the court papers could be made public at a sensitive time, he said. Of course, that meaning the election, before the election, in the campaign process right now. That prompted Judge Chutkan to assert once again that she considered the timing of the election to be irrelevant. She is not going to include campaign considerations into her scheduling the case. And she said this. She said, it strikes me that what you're trying to do is affect the presentation of evidence in this case so as not to impinge on an election. She said that to counsel. She said that publicly. That's her affirmation as she goes ahead and schedules this matter for future proceedings. I'm going to talk more about other things that she said during the course of that hearing. It included as well some other statements by the counsel for Donald Trump, issues surrounding Donald Trump's pressuring his former vice president to use his ceremonial role at the congressional proceeding, counting those votes, the Electoral College. Again, all of that, a part of the discussion presented to Judge Tanya Chutkan about what should happen in this trial going forward. As Amicus Law Review continues, more about that exchange and more about the meaning of both of these decisions coming out of trials and proceedings just this past week.
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW. Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody, join us next time as we welcome former State Senate Majority Leader Democrat Tim Cullen to the program to talk about his new book and great foundation helping Wisconsinites. Be here.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2.
How serious is youth vaping? Irreversible lung damage serious? 1 in 10 kids vape serious?
which warrants a serious conversation from a serious parental figure like yourself. Not the seriously know-it-all sports dad or the seriously smart podcaster. It requires a serious conversation that is best had by you. No, seriously, the best person to talk to your child about vaping is you. To start the conversation, visit talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us. You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.